Now it's time for my solo. Thank you very much for that special music. It's very, very good and praiseworthy, of course, to bless God's name. Of course, we'll have in March the Fort Worth congregation combining, so we're going to have, a lot more people that have talent for singing and special music. So that's going to be wonderful. That's going to be wonderful. We'll actually get to hear the horn, the trombone, and some other instruments that they play down there. So that's great. I'm looking forward to that. Have you ever overheard an ongoing argument between people, perhaps in your family, perhaps elsewhere, and this argument goes on and on and on, and you may be away for a period of time, and you come back, it's the same argument. The same argument, over and over and over again. Now, if you've been following with us, we've been covering the book of Job. And last time, we looked at these cycles of arguments that Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they were having with Job. Remember, Job would speak and they would speak and it was going back and forth. And eventually it petered out. It ended. And now I'm looking for something new. I'm looking for something new in the argument, something that's different. And you're not going to be disappointed. The book of Job gives us something new in the argument. It gives us something new. And we're entering a new phase, a new character, a young, opinionated, angry young man named Elihu. Elihu is his name. Now, in this book, he's given six chapters. Six chapters, chapter 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, and 37. That's a lot of chapters for this young man. Let's get right into the book. Job chapter 32. As we pick up the story, Job chapter 32 and in verse 1. So these three men ceased answering Job. Of course, those are the three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Now, it's important to note here that Job never claimed sinless perfection. It's important to note that. You'll recall the continual pattern of argumentation that the three friends were making. Job, you have sin in your life. Job, you're suffering. Suffering is caused by sin. That was their argument. And it was over and over and over and over again. Righteous people prosper. Unrighteous people do not. Now, Barnes's commentary notes that the Hebrew scholar Frederick Umbright adds clarity to this verse by appending these words. And they could not convince him of his unrighteousness. It was not merely because he was righteous in his own estimation that they ceased to answer him. It was because their arguments had no effect in convincing him, and they had nothing new to say. Job seemed to be bent on maintaining his own good opinion of himself in spite of all their reasons to the contrary, and so they sit down. So they failed to refute Job. They couldn't answer his argument. And so they sit down in silence. Verse 2. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. Now, we don't have time for this, but there's some who speculate that he may be a kindred of kin to Abraham. There's some line of thought that goes into that. Of course, it's not completely demonstrable because when you trace names, those kind of things, if there's no explicit statement to the fact, we can only surmise. So here he is. Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. Also, against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they found no answer and yet had condemned Job. So here you have Elihu. He's very angry. He's very angry at Eliphaz. He's very angry at Bildad. He's very angry at Zophar because they couldn't refute Job. There was no sense from Elihu's perspective where they were able to prove that Job was sinning, some great sin. So they couldn't do that. So he's angry with them. And it says, and yet had condemned Job. Now what's interesting about that phrase, and yet had condemned Job, in verse 3 of all the Hebrew Bibles, there's a little notation that the scribes have written in. And what they wrote was the Hebrew words, and condemned God. Of course, they were being very reverent. They didn't want to place into the text condemning God, so they put condemn Job. Condemning Job. Now, follow Elihu's thought here, because what Elihu is saying is their arguments actually condemned God. Here's how the argument would go. Since affliction comes from God to those guilty of sin, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they could not demonstrate any sin in Job. Therefore, Elihu concludes, their arguments are proving God to be unjust. They condemn God. And so Elihu is very upset with the three friends. He's also upset with Job. He's also upset with Job because he says, Job sought to justify himself rather than God. Of course, Job is saying, I'm right, and God, you're wrong. I'm right and you're wrong. There's something wrong with the moral order of the universe. I know that I haven't sinned some great, horrible sin. I know that. And yet, under the theory of retribution theology, if one sins, one is punished greatly. And so Job says, I haven't sinned. I haven't done this. I don't understand what's going on. You must be unjust. The moral order of the universe isn't right, God. You're not doing this correctly. And so Elihu says, Job sought to justify himself rather than God. The primary idea that Elihu stresses is that God is just. And Elihu is going to advance the argument by answering the question, could affliction, could suffering come to you? Could it come to me? Could it come to Job because of some other reason besides punitive actions? Could it come in another way? Now, let me tell you what I think about Elihu, because as I was preparing this message, I actually wanted it to be the last message. But in preparing this, I realized there's just not enough time to cover Elihu and then cover the next message where God speaks. And so I would shortchange God. And I didn't want to do that. I just didn't want to do that. I thought that would be a very bad idea. And so when we come to Elihu, this is a guy you just can't duck. If you're going to cover Job, you have to have an opinion on him. And so we're going to form an opinion on this one. He's somewhat of an enigma. In fact, for many, he's a zero. For others, he's an absolute hero. In the intertestamental book, the Testament of Job, it's quite clear that Elihu is some kind of satanic beast. It says plainly. Of course, this is intertestamental work. So, there you have one position, that Elihu is some form of the beast of Satan. Of course, there are other positions as well. Some say, well, he just presents a repetition of the arguments which all the other three friends provided. There's some evidence of that. Others say, well, Elihu is a prophet of God and he's a forerunner of Christ himself. For Elihu in Hebrew means he is God. But on the other hand, Buzite means contemptuous, despised. And there were some that argue that position as well. So again, you see, he's either very, very good, or he's very, very bad, or he's somewhere in between. There's a continuum. Some would say a God appearance, a prophet from God, an arrogant young knucklehead, a demon-possessed man, or perhaps even Satan himself. That's the continuum that you have to choose from. And there are no easy answers. You'll read scholars' various positions on this young man, Elihu. I look at this young man, and I believe he appears as a prophet from God, and at times, a young knucklehead. And we're going to look at that. At times, a prophet from God. He's very inspired at times, very insightful. But at other times, just not so insightful. He can be brilliant, and he can be banal in his speeches. So, let's continue reading in chapter, the same chapter in verse 4. Now, because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job, verse 5. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, answered and said, I am young in years, and you are very old. Therefore I was afraid and dared not declare my opinion to you. I said, age should speak, and multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there's a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do they always understand justice. I think he's correct there. I believe he's right. Great men, those who are aged, they don't always understand justice. More so, usually, than the younger. And so, when we read this, I don't want you to think that, well, all the older people are the wisest in the world, and the younger people are a bunch of knuckleheads. They're not. And I hope we in the church understand that we need both the young and the old. We don't espouse this generation gap in the sense of let's accept that as it is. We want the young and the old working together, living together, loving together, caring for each other. That's what we want. And Elihu gets it right. The question is about God's justice. That's what the question is. Verse 10, therefore I say, listen to me, and I will declare my opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasoning while you searched for what to say. I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. Lest you say, we have found wisdom, God will vanquish him, not man. Now he has not directed his words against me, so I will not answer him with your words. I think what Elihu is saying there is if these three could answer him, they would have been filled with such pride and self-sufficiency and arrogance that they were actually able to answer Job and what his problem was. And at the same time, Elihu says, and I'm not going to answer with the words that you three gave. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to use other words. And we'll find out if he lives up to that promise or not. Verse 18. For I am full of words. You can just imagine this young man sitting back for all these chapters, all this time, and he's sitting there listening, and at times wanting to open his mouth. He's just, I want to say something. Have you ever been like that? And you just, I want to say something, but I better hold back. And so he does. He holds back for all this time. And he gets to this point and he says, I'm full of words. The spirit within me compels me. Indeed, my belly's like wine that has no vent. It's ready to burst like new wineskins. I will speak that I might find relief. I must open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray, show partiality to anyone. Let me not flatter any man, for I do not know how to flatter, else my Maker would soon take me away. Chapter 33 and verse 1. But please, Job, hear my speech and listen to all my words. Now I open my mouth, and my tongue speaks in my mouth. My words come from my upright heart. My lips utter pure knowledge. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives life. If you can answer me, set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Truly, I am your spokesman before God. I have been formed out of clay. And you'll recall in Job chapter 19, verse 25, Job actually did call for a mediator. He called for someone to intervene on his behalf because he said, I'm not getting anywhere with God. I wish I had a mediator. I wish, God, you're wrong. I wish I had someone to stand up for me. I wish I could take God to court. That's what he says. And Elihu says, I'm your man. I'm your spokesman. I'm your mediator. Look at me, Job. Look at me. Verse 7, surely no fear of me will terrify you, nor will my hand be heavy upon you. Now that's what he promises. Let's see if he lives up to his promises. Where is Elihu, I believe, not right? In chapter 33, in verses 8 and 9, it says, Elihu says, surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the voice of your word saying, I am clean without transgression. I am innocent, neither is there iniquity in me. Well, actually, Job didn't quite say that. If you look at Job in chapter 16, verse 17, and you won't have to turn there, but Job says, my prayer is pure. It's my prayer that is pure. Again, Job did not claim absolute perfection. He did not. The same verse here that Elihu gives the accusation. He says, and you claimed you're without transgression in verse 9. Well, in chapter 7, verse 21, Job says, why do you not pardon my transgression? In chapter 13, verse 23, make me know my transgression. Again, Job feels like he's in a box. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know what's happening. He knows he has no great sin in his life, and he thinks as if God's punishing him for this great sin that he has, but God's not showing him what the sin is. And he says, show me my transgression. Show me. In chapter 14, verse 17, he says, my transgression is sealed up in a bag. And he's speaking to God. You've sealed it up in a bag. You're not letting me see what's inside the bag. In chapter 33, verse 9, Elihu accuses Job. He says, I am innocent. The word there is kaf in Hebrew. Well, the only problem here is this word kaf in this form, chapter 33, verse 9, that Elihu says, Job claims. It's found one time in all the Bible. Do you know where that one time is? Right off the lips of Elihu. Job didn't claim innocence. He didn't claim innocence. That's the only place in the Hebrew where it's found. Again, 33 and verse 9. I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. The Hebrew word avon In chapter 17 or 7, verse 21, Job says, "Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity?" Chapter 10, verses 6 and 7. "That you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin, although you know I am not wicked." Again, Job says, "I'm not this great wicked man. But somehow it's like you're looking for small little sins that you can hold against me." In chapter 13, verse 23, "How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me to know my transgression and my sin." Chapter 13 and verse 26, "You make me to inherit the iniquities of my youth." Speaking to God there, he's saying, I don't know what my sin is, but maybe it's the iniquities of my youth. Maybe that's what it is. In chapter 14, verse 17, "My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover," which means to plaster over, "my iniquity." The same Hebrew word. You plaster over it. You're collecting evidence against me. It's the same Hebrew word. So again, Job doesn't claim innocence or perfection or sinlessness. The next accusation that Elihu gave in chapter 34, verses 7 and 8. "What man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, who goes in companies with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men?" Well, what Job actually said was not quite like that. What happens here is Elihu is really quoting Eliphaz. It's Eliphaz who says in chapter 15, verse 16, "How much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water." There's a few more instances where Elihu actually misquotes Job. And of course, in chapter 32 or 33, verse 32, Elihu says, "If you have anything to say, answer me, for I seek to justify you." And of course, in the last part of Elihu's speaking, in chapter 34, 36, and 37, he says, "Oh, that Job were tried to the end, because his answers are like those of wicked men, for he adds rebellion to his secret sin. He claps his hands in derision among us. He multiplies his words against God." In chapter 35, 2 and 3, "Do you think this is right? Do you say, my righteousness is more than God's? For you say, what advantage will it be to me? What profit shall I have more than this if I had not sinned?" And again, Elihu in this case is putting words in Job's mouth. In chapter 21, in verse 14 and 15, what Job actually says is, "Yet they say to God, depart from us, for we do not desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we have if we pray to him?" The "they" in that case refers back to the wicked. Job is actually quoting the wicked. And Elihu puts those words in Job's mouth as if Job's saying that. But Job didn't actually say that. Now, if he was wrong in those areas, where was he right? Because he was right. In chapter 32 and verse 2 again. "Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God." Elihu's right on that. And I know he's right because in the speech that God gives in chapter 40, if you look at that, turn the page or two, chapter 40 and verse 2, "Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him?" Are you going to instruct him? Are you going to justify yourself before the Almighty rather than yourself? You're saying I'm wrong, Job. You're seeking to justify yourself rather than me. In that, Elihu is right. Elihu is also right in chapter 34 and verse 35. In chapter 34 and verse 35, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. And God corroborates that in chapter 38 and verse 2. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Job did do that, and Elihu was right. So I think his basic stance is right. And he has important things to tell us, important things to say to us. He assumes that God's justice is there, and it should always be there. But he also leaves a place for mystery. Elihu also leaves a place for mystery. And so we've come to the other side of the ledger. Why should we accept Elihu's words as truth? I think John Piper gives five of the best reasons I've seen on why we should accept Elihu's words as truth. Number one, he says, his speech is presented as something new. The words of Elihu are introduced in chapter 32, not as a continuation or repetition of what the three friends had said, but as something new. And you recall in chapter 32, verses 1 through 3, Elihu comes on the scenes and he says, I'm not going to say the same thing the old three friends said. I'm against them, but I'm also against you, Job. And so it's presented as something new. Something new is going to happen here. He disagrees with both sides of the argument. And so he's going to take us beyond the old argument. Secondly, six chapters are devoted to his words. Six chapters. Now, you think about it. We looked earlier on in the previous message and how the chapters were divided, and you saw the symmetry of the chapters. You recall how they spoke, and the three friends got shorter and shorter and shorter and briefer and briefer and briefer until Bildad only had six verses, and Zophar doesn't even speak at all, while Job is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And Piper's point here is, why give six chapters to Elihu if it's simply more of the same? And I think he's right. It's not going to be more of the same. There's something crucial that's going to be said here. Thirdly, Job doesn't argue with Elihu. Now, you'll recall with those other three friends, Job argued mightily. But with Elihu, Elihu came to Job and he said, if you can answer me, Job, then answer me. Answer me. And Job has not a word. Job has not a word. In fact, in chapter 42, verse 6, Job does repent of some of the things that he actually says, which shows that Elihu's rebuke really isn't that far off the mark. It's not that far off the mark. Fourthly, God doesn't rebuke Elihu like he does the other three friends. And I just mentioned that. And you'll recall in 42, verse 7, you'll remember God where he actually says, my wrath is kindled against you and your two friends. And he's speaking to Eliphaz there. So he doesn't give that. He doesn't censor, you might say, Elihu. And fifthly, Elihu offers something new and helpful. He really does offer a new understanding of the suffering of a righteous that Job and his three friends had not perceived. And his insight does make some sense out of the apparent arbitrary nature of suffering. So where does Elihu advance the argument? Let's look at that. Chapter 33 and verse 13. Chapter 33 and verse 13. Why do you contend with him? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words. For God may speak in one way or in another, yet man does not perceive it. In a dream, in the vision of the night when deep sleep falls upon men, while slumbering on their beds. Then he opens the ears of men, and he seals their instruction in order to turn man from his deeds and conceal pride from man. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. Man is also chastened with pain on his bed and with strong pain in many of his bones, so that his life abhors bread and his soul succulent food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones stick out where once they're not seen. Verse 23. If there's a messenger for him, a mediator, one among a thousand, to show man his uprightness, then he is gracious to him and says, deliver him. That's God saying to the messenger, deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. So Elihu in verse 29 summarizes, behold, God works all these things twice, in fact, three times with a man, to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life. And so Elihu's contention is that God uses dreams, God uses pain, God uses suffering as a means of showing us our pride. Our pride. And in mercy, he sends a mediator or a messenger to deliver a person from going down to the pit and awakening them to the light. Now that's new. None of the other three friends, they offered that. That's new. But there's more. In Job 36 and verse 5. Job 36 and verse 5. Behold, God is mighty, but despises no one. He's mighty in strength of understanding. He does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but they are on the thrones with kings, for he has seated them forever, and they are exalted. Now, if you stop reading right there, you would say, this sounds a lot like a life as Bildad and Zophar. It sounds a lot like them. But let's not stop reading. Verse 8, and if they, who's the they? That's the righteous who does not withdraw, or God does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous. If they, so that's interesting. He's got the righteous. He's got the righteous, he says, who are bound in fetters. And they're held in cords of affliction. So he has the righteous bound in chains and the righteous in cords of affliction. Again, that's a new category. That's something the other three never even imagine. Verse 9. Then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they've acted defiantly. Verse 10. And he opens their ears to instruction and commands that they turn from iniquity. If they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasure. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword and shall die without knowledge. But the hypocrites in heart store up wrath. They do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the perverted person. He delivers the poor in their affliction. That's interesting. He delivers the poor in their affliction, and he opens their ears in oppression. Again, that's a new category. The category is there are what we might say the righteous sinner. There's the righteous sinner. One who is righteous before God and yet still sins. The righteous sinner. If I can give an illustration here, I think what Elihu is trying to say, you have this beaker, you might have this sediment of pride at the bottom of our lives. This sediment of pride, which is there, and Elihu's arguing, it's in all of us. It's in all of us. And then comes the trial and the storms of life. And all this stuff that was there and was latent. And we thought we were so good, and we thought we were so right, and we thought, I'm a good man, I'm a good woman. When all this suffering starts happening, things start coming out of your mouth, and your conduct and your behavior starts changing. And you start looking at yourself, I didn't know I could say that. I didn't know I could do that. And you begin to look at yourself a little bit differently. Because what you thought was impossible for you is indeed possible. There's this layer of pride, this sediment of pride in all of us. Perhaps Elihu is saying that God is trying to get your attention, Job. And here's the master surgeon. And he's got a scalpel in his hand. And he's taking this scalpel, and you have this pride. And he reaches down with the suffering, and he cuts into you. And it hurts, and it's painful. But if God is going to remove the pride in my life, why should I begrudge the scalpel from the hand of God? Matthew 5, verse 8 says, it's the pure in heart. Blessed are they, for they shall see God. And if God could cleanse Sam Sweat, if God could cleanse my heart and your heart, let us not begrudge the scalpel of God. In the book of Psalms 119, verse 67. The psalmist writes, Before I was afflicted, I went astray. In verse 71, it is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Sometimes we can only see clearly through the lens of tears. When you have the suffering and you have the pain, that's when you see more clearly. And you begin to look at yourself, and is not this a Passover theme? That we look at ourselves and we examine ourselves and we say, I'm not as good as I thought I was. And the only good that's in me is God Himself. The only good, the only righteous is God Himself. And the rest, my righteousness, my goodness, is nothing but filthy rags. I think that's part of what Elihu is getting at. And so therefore, let the scalpel be applied. That's Elihu's fundamental contribution. He opens up a new array for the purpose of suffering. A new vista, a new way of looking at suffering. For him, the purpose of suffering is good pedagogy. It's educational. It's chastisement. It's redemptive. It's to bring one back from the pit, from death, so that they may be brought back into the light. And we could read further And Elihu goes on to magnify the greatness of God through the coming of a wondrous storm that he sees on the horizon as it gets closer and closer and closer. And he, of course, serves as a bridge to the very appearance of God himself. What can we learn from Elihu? First, separate the pain from the interpretation of pain. Separate the pain from the interpretation of pain. That's not always the case, but it's a new alternative. Separate the pain from the interpretation of pain. Elihu correctly understood that Job needed to see suffering from a larger perspective. There's more than one alternative. If you went to the doctor and you said, I've got this pain, I've got this agony, and they analyze it and they look at it and they say, I don't know what the problem is. We've looked at your blood work, we've looked at this, we can't find the answer. For Job's three friends, that's an immediate answer. You've got sin in your lives. Elihu says, perhaps it's something else. Perhaps it's chastisement from God. Perhaps it's God's way of getting your attention. Perhaps that's what it is. And yet, we know from Job, perhaps it's even something else. Because in chapter 1 and in chapter 40 of Job, we realize Job wasn't persecuted and sought because of his unfaithfulness. Job was sought out because he was faithful. It wasn't that Job was unrighteous that God said, here, take a look at him. It was because he was righteous that God pointed him out. And so Job took the arrows of Satan himself. And so might you. If you're faithful, if you're righteous, and you're trying to live a God-ordained life, you will receive the arrows of Satan. Count on it. Count on it. You will receive the fiery darts of Satan. When Jesus Christ was sending out the 12 in Matthew 10, verse 25, he says it's enough for the disciple that he looks like his teacher and a servant like his master. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, that is the prince of the demons, if they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of his household? Separate the pain from the interpretation of the pain. Secondly, listen to your friends, but make up your own mind. Listen to your friends, but make up your own mind. Now, my assumption in saying that is that you and I are going to use the Word of God as our baseline for authority. That's our baseline. So someone comes to us, a friend, or even our own mental cogitation, our thinking within, and we say, well, I think this. Let's go back to here. Let's make sure it agrees with this. Let this be our authority. Listen to your friends, but let this be your final authoritative summation of all things. Listen to it, and listen to them, because you may have an unskilled, opinionated, youthful person, or for that matter, any unlikely source, come to you with faulty reasoning at times, and yet with good reasoning at times, and be right on the mark and be off the mark. So listen to your friends, and you and I will have to decide when we're listening to those people, because most of the time they're trying to help. Will we return evil for good? Or will we return good to them? And lastly, ascribe righteousness to your Maker. Ascribe righteousness to your Maker. Look at Job 36, verse 3. Job 36 and verse 3. Elihu says, I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker. Be mature enough to say, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know what's happening. I feel like I'm in a box. I wish God would answer me. I don't know what's happening. Why, God? Why? I don't know why I don't have a job. I don't know why these people seem angry with me at work. I don't know why I can't have children. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm not married. I don't know why. I don't know why I can't seem to get into this school. I can't seem to get in this program. I don't know why. It's only the blind person in life who doesn't look at their problems or the problems of this world and doesn't ask why. We all ask why. But in your asking, in my asking, ascribe righteousness to your Maker. That's a non-negotiable. God is just, God is good, God is righteous, and God is fair. Ascribe righteousness to your Maker, no matter what you might think. And so ends the cycle of human speeches. Let me end by saying that Elihu may be an imperfect and at times arrogant vessel of God. But aren't we all? Aren't we all at times? I know I am. But yet at times, we can be very insightful. And God can use vessels that would be fit for no other purpose than to be thrown away, than to use them for His great purpose and to give insight and understanding to other people. And so He does. Elihu offers us alternatives to our suffering that are beyond the tit-for-tat theology of his three friends. And moreover, God is so careful to name individually each of the others whom repentance was required, the three friends. And so because of that, I'm not comfortable censoring what God does not censor. I'm not comfortable going there. I'm not comfortable saying Elihu is this evil satanic beast. God doesn't censor him. And so I'm not going to censor him either. I think he had good things to say. I think he opened up a vista that Job and the others just hadn't even thought of. And it's something for all of us to think of. It's something for all of us to consider. So, we've met Elihu. Next time, we're going to explore the climax of the book. And that's where God speaks. God says some of the most interesting things. But what may be more interesting is what He doesn't say. And so, until next time, have a good Sabbath.